Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, it's Raghu with Mind Rolling, an old friend and who I miss so much, Bob Thurman. Bob, welcome to Mind Rolling. Oh,
thank you, Raghu. Miss you too. Out there in Ojai, sunny Ojai. Here we are in Woodstock, in the Hudson Valley rainforest.
Yes, you have rain. We haven't seen rain in about 14 years, Bob.
I know.
It's really bad out here.
They should really hire some, Cherokees and Navajo and Hopi and come out and Tibetans and do some rain dances.
Yeah.
They never think of that.
Yeah. They should also re-educate all of us white people here who took over this country and created what we seem to have now, which is a very apocalyptic environment.
That's right. Absolutely.
We need their wisdom, don't we?
Absolutely. There's a lovely Sarah Johnson from the Navajo, but who is a Stanford graduate or graduate student. Mm. And she says that the deep ecologists think that Mother Earth wouldn't miss us. I call us pink people rather than white people. I don't see any white faces except for corpses. I call us pink, but anyway, that those deep ecologists say that Mother Earth wouldn't miss us, but she says they would miss the native people because the native people used to take care of things,
right?
And Mother Earth would miss them.
Yeah.
I like that.
Oh boy!
I know she says it in a nice way.
Yeah.
She knows that we were actually born here and we didn't come in with the first wave of genocide committers. And we could change our ways, and we are, some of us. And so we can be native people if we make an effort.
Yes. We're, we're experimenting more in that with the podcast network to have more representation and diversity, to all of those voices and be able to follow some of the some of this wisdom, amazing wisdom. So, well, have you been in this? I mean, we really haven't talked much at all in over probably a year or something.
Really?
How have you been navigating this world of ours?
Yeah, sure. We're fine. Well, we've been home a lot. The COVID has given a nice opportunity, as tragic as it has been for many and as it fundamentally is, it has given us a nice opportunity to be on a long retreat and focus on what is real. And I'm very happy to have put out this Wisdom is Bliss book.
Yeah.
At a time when everyone is sort of feeling a little something, but maybe re-blooming into some new thing. And I really can't believe it. Look at the amazing surprises that we are having. I was not in favor of Joe Biden initially. I was more Bernie kind of on the Bernie level, except for his use of the slogan of socialism. But otherwise, I was really for Bernie. But what Joe Biden has really transformed himself. He used to vote for, he voted for invasion of Iraq. He voted for prison system. He voted for a lot of dumb things when he was senator. And now he's born again. He's come to Jesus. He's come to Buddha. He's come to Krishna. He's really, he's got Kamala right up there with him.
Yeah, but he's also being vilified as well in so many different
ways. The loonies, the last thing the loonies want to do is to have someone try to run the place competently. You know, someone who is not as miserable as them. All they do when they get in charge is they just make everybody miserable because they are so miserable. That's the sad thing, you know. Yeah, but I take great heart from that because our group, you know, the happy people, the reason this happened is we got complacent and we sat back and half of us didn't bother to vote and we didn't go out, we didn't make a donation, we didn't do this, didn't do that. And then the guys who are miserable but who think if they have power, they'll be happy. And they rushed and got all the power. And then they did a lot of dumb things and wrecked a lot of, making a lot of mess. And they're continuing to do it. And they're mad when somebody comes up and decides, hey, let's have a Green New Deal. Yeah. Let's adapt to reality instead of living in a hamburger and Super Bowl fantasy, you know, hamburger, Chevrolets, you know, weird pharmaceuticals and Super Bowl. That's it.
Yeah. And French fries. And talk about reality. So you got me on the first line. So Bob has this wonderful book, as he just mentioned, Wisdom is Bliss. And you got me on the first chapter one, which is the Buddha Path. This book is about getting real while having fun along the way. This is not your typical archetypical Buddhist book suggest. Ooh, wow, this could be fun. This isn't just this dry Buddhist rhetoric. This could be fun if you integrate some of this in your life. But I'll tell you a story of our good friend Sharon Salzberg. One time at one of those retreats in Maui, I was doing a thing with her and Duncan Trussell. You remember our friend Duncan?
Yes, sure, Duncan, yeah.
He said, look, Sharon, let's get down to it. What do you do when you get out of bed in the morning? What do you do? What's your practice?
Right.
So she said, well, I have to get out and brush my teeth, and then I sit and get real.
Oh, good.
And that was the thing. Sit and get real. Just be present in a way that allows for all possibilities. It was just a wonderful thing. And so, yeah, this is very much of what you're talking about.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, I say, I don't want to make it, I'm not into making it, it's not a Buddhist book, Wisdom is Bliss. It's a Buddhist book. I'm into Buddhism, not Buddhism in this case, because I'm following Dalai Lama, who doesn't want to convert anybody. You know, I really miss Ram Dass, because remember where he asked me, what can he do that all his friends were Buddhists and he was a Hindu and he had a soul and he wanted to, you know, he had Atma, you know, a soul, and he wanted to go. And they said he couldn't have one. And remember, and then I told him, I didn't appeal to Buddha. To an obvious Buddha. I appealed to Yogi Berra. Remember that? I said, Ramdas, relax. Follow Yogi Berra's teaching, Dharma teaching. When you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And he loved that. He was talking about Yogi Berra the rest of the time.
Yeah.
And I wish he was still here, because I'm more and more into this, because His Holiness has heightened the emphasis. I mean, the Dalai Lama, you know, my guru of the nowadays, he's kind of my buddy too, but he's also really my guru in those contexts. Mm. But he's flexible, so we can also still be buddies. That's what's so nice about him. But anyway, he is really coming out more on what he calls his fourth aim in life.
Oh.
And his fourth aim in life, you know, he has the three names that he always just talks a lot about. And now the fourth one he's really emphasizing, which is bringing India's own inter-science back into its full gauge, you know, full bore function, which involves retrieving the Buddhist side of it. You know, the great Nalanda, the great Buddhist universities that were the great universities of the world, actually, for 1,200 years. And then they were knocked out by various invasions into India, where the invaders burned them and so on. And then India sort of had the Hindu side left, which is full of the same things. But there's a few things that the Buddhists were adding, which were integral to Indian classical civilization. And so his idea is not bring it back as Buddhism, but bring it back as India's own inner science, spiritual science, and adding, you know, like complementing and heightening those elements that really come from, you know, in historical terms, the Shramana tradition, not the Brahmana or the Vedic tradition, but the Shramana. Mm. And that means the sort of yogis, the yogi side, you know, because Vedas were kind of not so much the yogi side, you know, they were the kings.
What does Shramana translate as, Bo?
Shramana, well, that's an Indian word. Shramana means, well, I translate it as vacationer, but it means a seeker, and most people translate it as ascetic. Because they're the people who give up the household life,
yeah,
you know, and who go into like the swamis, you know, the Hinduism didn't have lifelong monks until the Buddhist side was driven out, and then they had to reproduce that. But other than that, when you're a student, you can be celibate, but when you get older, you have to have a household. Then again, when you retreat to vanaprastha, what they call, you know, you go back to the ashram, then you become a shramana again, and you're sort of more or less celibate again. You know, you're a yogi.
Yeah.
And then finally sannyasin, you completely abandon every kind of household aspect. Mm. And that was their four aims of life. When Buddhism was adding the institution where you dropped out, you know, turned on, tuned in, and dropped out to really develop your spiritual side professionally, 100% woman as well as man, which was not so much allowed in the householder side. You know, you had to do your duty there, pay your taxes, serve in the military, serve in the priesthood, or whatever it is. So this is the Dalai's fourth aim, and I'm really into it. You know, yoga, especially in the terms of yoga, because the yoga was always what attracted me to India, and the Buddhist yoga of mind, the yoga of the emotions, is really very important. Bhakti is a yoga of the emotions, and the Bodhisattva path is the yoga of the emotions, and they complement each other magnificently. Mm. And I wish I could, as I said, if Ramdas was here, he would love the synthesis of this. You know, as he said, all his friends are Buddhists, because they're more doing the yoga. But then he said he wants to be a Hindu. No problem. Because it's Indian spiritual science is the thing, is what it is. The ist part, this ist and that ist, is less relevant, you know.
Have you had, I have not heard him publicly say this, anything like this. Has this been in some of his public addresses, you know, doing the Zoom?
Oh, he's holding it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah, nowadays, all the time.
Really?
Because, you know, his first three are really, remember, first one is, as a human being, he wants transformative common human values. That's his whole religion of kindness idea instead of this and that religion. because he doesn't believe at this time in history we should be exclusivists and say, oh, I'm going to convert you from Judaism to Hinduism, or I'm going to convert you back to Judaism, or I'm going to head you, everybody should be a Christian, or everybody should be a Buddhist. He's against that. You know, he's into everybody should stick with grandma's religion, but they are free to learn yogas from all of the education systems that the different spiritualities have elaborated in all different cultures and enrich their understanding of grandma's religion, but then sit there in the pew or in the synagogue or in the thing and hold hands with granny and don't upset granny by saying, granny, I'm sorry, I'm a Buddhist. I'm not going in that house with you. Mm. You know, that's, we don't need to do that. You know, that's, that makes granny unhappy. And then also the sort of bosses of the religious traditions, you know, the big shots, the popes, the head guys, then they get into, and the cardinals and the institutions, they get into competing for market share. And then that leads to lethal jihads and crusades and, you know, modern versions, you know, online or something, you know, and that's no good. So he feels he sold three popes. He's shared this with three popes who, like, in conversation with him, they agree. But then when they get back out there, they have to do their gig to expand their institution, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they tend to fall into it, right? And so that he wants everyone to stop doing that sort of thing and instead try to go to the heart of everywhere and find everything, you know, find it in Jesus's feelings, in Jesus's yoga of, you know, good Rabbi Jesus with his great rabbi teaching of altruism and ethicality and so forth, turn the other cheek, and Buddha's thing, and Lao Tzu's thing, and Krishna's thing, whoever it is, and Hanuman. We mustn't forget Hanuman, our monkey teacher.
Yes, you know? Yes. This all reminds me. Actually, you know, you're talking about His Holiness talking about, you know, this isn't a matter of converting to another religion whatsoever, and you should not do something like that. Of course, I came home from India after being with Neem Karoli Baba, with Maharaji, and given me the name. And, Mom, my name is no longer Mitchell. It's Raghu. Get it? My mother was a Marxist, okay? At the she was like, are you? It was really terrible what I did. Terrible what I did.
I know.
But fortunately, and then, many years later, I was with a man named Casey Tiwari that maybe Krishnadas has mentioned to you in when you've been together. He was one of our mentors. He was Krishnadas. He called him his Indian father because he spent more time with him than any of us. Anyhow, I was with him at one time. I took my mother to India, and she wanted to go to India, and she just had this delightful time. This was after Maharaji's time, and we went on a little bit of a yatra with this man who was a knocked-out yogi who, in the guise of a school teacher, we're actually just doing a movie, documentary about him. Anyhow, he says to me, you know, I wonder if, you know, you're Jewish, and you're from the Jewish religion, and, you know, you do not give up your religion and take on another religion. This is not the reality. So he said, would you mind, though? I'd love to hear a prayer. And my mother and I thought, I wonder. Oh, I know one. And we sang this prayer, Ein Keloheinu. There's nothing but the one. Nothing but Ein Kadone. There's nothing but the one. He went into samadhi. Sitting there in front of us. He just went out on it, which he used to do all the time.
That's great.
Yeah. And then my mother said, oh my God, what happened to him? You know, he's not breathing. And it was a big lesson about that, though. So
it's
so great His Holiness is doing this.
You know, these Tibetan lamas come here and then they make Dharma centers. And then people are into like, they want to be Buddhist with the Lama, you know. And the Dalai Lama comes and says, no, I don't want you to. He even said recently in a movie he made about his conversations with David Bohm, who also used to talk with Krishnamurti a lot, you know. And he said in his interviews for that film, he said, I just want everyone to know that in my entire life, I have never given Dharma teaching with the motive of making people into Buddhists.
Right.
He said, that's never been my thing. And he says, I don't want mutual competition and conversion. I want everyone to share their riches with everyone else and people to use it within their own cultural matrix. And of course, and then he, in that kind of lecture, he doesn't go into saying, but of course, you know, you will then moderate any kind of elements of exclusivism, which wouldn't even enable you to study anything else, you know, like the, the very exclusivist versions of the different religions. But they are not the only versions of those religions, you know, the crusade mentality and the jihad mentality and the everybody's got to be a Buddhist mentality is only certain types of interpretations. And the really deeper ones are learn how to live, how to be real, and what is reality. And that also brings in, he makes a big thing about, he doesn't want to convert people away from secularism either. If that's their thing, to observe nature, not be dogmatic, not have blind faith in anything, but only what's sensible and reasonable, he's all for that. And that they can keep that situation and then observe their mind and be mindful, and they get and use these tools to live well with in whatever cultural feeling they have, you know. So I really like that, and that's why I renamed the Four Noble Truths setting forth the Eightfold Path, the educational curriculum of how to live well that Buddha left us. And but I do it in terms of the four friendly, fun facts.
I just was noting that, and I was going to say that's really what this book is about. It gives the possibility of anyone getting information that can help on a day-to-day basis without going through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and, oh, I got to be a Buddhist and all that, all kinds of arcane information.
That's right, and even the name. Because, you know, the early guys, the word satya can certainly mean truth, but it also means the reality, and it therefore also means a fact, and just something that's factual. So, you know, it was translated as truth by people because they said, oh, Buddhism is a religion, so therefore they have to have something, they have a credo. And, you know, they recite the credo. Oh, yeah, I believe in suffering, and I believe in nirvana, and I believe in causes, I believe in the path. But Buddha never asked for belief in any of those things. He asked to notice the suffering and don't freak out about it, because it happens when you don't know what you're doing. You're going to bump into things and suffer. There has a cause. Then his real discovery, which everybody does not emphasize because it seems so outlandish and preposterous to people, is that actually when you understand life, it's a gas. It's nirvana. It's fabulous. It's terrific. Everything, not just some far off place, some elsewhere is nirvana. It's nirvana when you're really, you know, aware of what's around you and you're really in love with it. You realize, you know, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and then you see the beauty in life, and that's nirvana. Beauty in life is nirvana.
But
that's the realer reality. That's why I put the thing, wisdom is bliss, because wisdom is what you know that nirvana about.
You know? You're sure it's not ignorance? Didn't they used to teach us ignorance is bliss?
that's what the people say who are scared of it. And the other thing is Eastern cultures too, all of the world's cultures of the last few thousand years, they take to the common man, you know, and woman, they want to frighten them. And they frighten them that because they want them to feel they need the king or the president or the legislature or whatever it is, and they need the high priest and they need the dogma, and then they need the outside consultant, namely God, personified as sort of somebody a little bigger than the king, but basically just anthropomorphized into, made into like somebody standing behind the president or the king or whatever it is, so that you can depend on them. And so that's why they try to scare you. Whereas Buddha, as a rebel, he wanted you not to be scared, because you don't do that well when you're scared. You know, you don't open up to see the beauty of things when you're scared. You hide. And you're too scared. You think you get hurt if you open up, you know?
Yeah, so what's great here, these four friendly facts.
Yes.
Four friendly facts. So it's a model for a just like you would go to a doctor when you have something wrong and you get a diagnosis. So I love here. So the first friendly fact is a recognition of the symptom. We all have recognition of the symptom. The diagnosis of its cause, no problem. The prognosis that gives us a likelihood and the nature of the cure. We're all looking for that. Yes. And then the therapeutic method that counters the malignant effects of the cause. Maybe break that out a little further into the way that we actually can work with ourselves.
That's
to
right.
Bring
well,
this
the first,
to...
Sure. Well, the first fun fact, and it is fun, to acknowledge that blundering around, you know, feeling separate from everybody and continually finding conflict and friction and struggle is bound to be stressful. So it's kind of nice to be told. I had a conversation with it about it with Sharon. And she always mentions how relieved she was when she heard that, well, gee whiz, all this suffering I've had in my childhood and growing up, that's normal because I didn't really know what was happening and it was just all going on around me. And so I shouldn't feel that it's especially me and I'm bad and something, you know, I'm being punished for some terrible thing, which I didn't do. So that was a fun fact then, although it sounds kind of contradictory to say it's a fun fact to realize that normal staggering around and bumping into things is going to be suffering. What's fun about it is then you don't feel that you did it bad. It's just the way it is. And then when you find out that the cause is because you were approaching life based on some misapprehension about your own role in it, and you felt you were the center of it, and then you kept wondering, how come other people don't think I'm the center? In fact, on top of it, they don't think I am. They think they are. That's ridiculous. You know, and then you realize that really wasn't a really proper way to go about it. So that's the cause. And then, gee whiz, I can still be here and be totally healthy, totally with it, interact way better when I realize that it is just great, you know, itself. And I can relax having to be the center because it's the whole thing is the center and they're all the center too. And it's great. And we can really relate without friction and have a good time. But to really make sure I'm doing that, I need to educate myself about how to interact with them better and what not, how not to be harmful, how to be helpful. And I have to have a view about our simple openness, how it's necessary to not be dogmatic and not always insist on being right and be open to what they think, see their perspective, always be open to the bigger picture. And that's the view. And then have a motive of opening endlessly and infinitely, and then being ethical and not harmful, and then developing meditative ability to control my emotions by being more aware of how they arise so I don't send out negative vibes and have bad emotions and have them make me do bad things. And then finally, really focus on the nature of the deepest level of reality, what it really is, and discover and see nirvana everywhere. See it right there in every hair of Raghu's nice white mustache. That's all nirvana, an elegant mustache. I'm so jealous because I'm tired of shaving and I'm old and retired, but my mustache is so scraggly I can't take it. I have I have a lot of head hair. But
yes,
my face hair,
just be happy. We should both just be happy about the head of hair that we still have.
I am.
That's all there is to it.
And nirvana is in a good head of hair.
Exactly.
It's on every follicle, you know, if you really notice it. And in case you don't, it's in that beautiful smooth dome, you know, that like Kojak the detective used to sport
no
on TV.
That,
and Yul Brynner with his cool dome. So that's going to be very elegant and nirvanic as well, you know, if that happens to be your hairdo. You know?
How about talking about, we need to talk a little about, you mentioned it briefly, but motivation is a big thing. And, you know, the motivation to stop being so self, is yourself as the center of the universe. And when that gets attacked by virtue of it being so much full of ignorance,
right.
then it becomes a real problem. So right. motivation around...
So, well, the thing there, that's a beautiful thing. You know, psychologists have a really, you know, academic psychologists in the West have a really dumb thing where they claim there's no such thing as altruism because they've observed that someone who cultivates altruism and thinks that way and lives that way and becomes more and more that way, they're doing it because they get great satisfaction out of it. So therefore, there's a selfish motive in altruism. So it's not real altruism. They get into the... Whereas Shantideva or any of the Buddhist psychologists and Buddha, who was a psychologist, therapist, he noted that as a bonus. That is to say, you learn that when you open up a little and you feel what other people feel and then interact smoothly and lovingly and pleasantly with that, it makes you happy. When you act to just make yourself happy, you're always dissatisfied because you don't have enough. So you're always evaluating what you got. What do I get out of it all? And it's never enough, so you're never happy. So the way of the method has to do with looking at the sort of slightly paradoxical nature of life. The less you worry about yourself being in the center, the better you feel. So then you're actually succeeding in the original selfish idea of having it all when you really want others to have it all. So they mutually work really well. And when you learn that, then you get a strong motive. You get a self-interest in order to fulfill others' interests and to be altruistic. And as the Dalai Lama likes to say beautifully, he says, if you want to be successfully selfish and get what you want, be altruistic. Because when you're altruistic, the first person who gets happy is you. You may not be that skillful with your altruism, and you may not help the other person as much as you wanted to. But by trying, you're going to feel better.
Yeah.
And so that's a fail-safe. You know, I love it. It's just so cool.
And I think that motivation comes from the experiential nature of actually extending yourself outside of your box, and then in that moment there's a realization, and your worry about yourself, as soon as you're walking across the street, somebody needs help and you go to help them, before that you were thinking, oh my God, today is just horrible, my wife is this and my kids don't go to bother. And then suddenly you do that action because it's in front of you, you have no choice. That's and you do the action, and then you realize in the doing of the action, your stuff, quote unquote, just absolutely dissipated nothing.
It's bracketed. That's right. That is absolutely right.
So that's systematic.
The point is, that's a systematic method, you know, because we're badly educated in our society. And I mean Harvard, Exeter, whatever you want, expensive, fancy schools. Mm. But none of them educate us to cultivate positive emotions and to diminish and to uncultivate and unlearn negative habits. And they act like that's sort of your mom's supposed to help you do that, or your psychotherapist or whatever life experience will help you do that. And we just teach you facts and skills and how to go around and manipulate things in the world. And you know, as Dalai Lama said, when he got honorary degree, doctorate at Columbia, doctor of humanity, you know, he got that. And he said, great, I love it. Education is the most important thing in the world. He said, we cannot have any decent society anywhere without education. He said, but I worry about your education, he said to the trustees and faculty of Columbia. He says, because you focus only on educating the clever brain and you don't educate the good heart. And a clever brain without a good heart could actually be dangerous for others, because the person would be manipulative and whatever, using cleverness to manipulate others. And also dangerous for the person, because when they live like that, they are going to get more and more unhappy themselves. They might get more money, they might get more status and power, but then they'll feel more isolated from other people. Other people won't like them. They'll feel that, they'll get more closed off, and they're going to have an unhappy life. Mm. And then they'll be worse. So he said, please think about trying to cultivate how to educate the heart as part of academic mission. And it just, you know, they all nodded and looking very benign. And, oh, he's so great telling us this. And yes, of course, we should do that. And we should be not, you know, the dorm master should go and like take a look at the people in the dorm. But no idea that there's a course in that. Like how to develop a better mental concentration, how to become aware of your own emotional narratives that are in your mind, which is what mindfulness does.
Yeah.
You know, mindfulness doesn't make you into a geek, like a Hindu geek or a Buddhist geek or a Sufi geek or a Kabbalah geek. Mindfulness makes you a better manager of your own inner emotions because it develops more inner mental freedom.
Yeah.
And you don't have to just jump on every impulse that you have because you see how... where the impulse comes from. It's like learning to play a pinball machine. You know how to flip which lever, you know? And as I would say, mindfulness is like getting a clicker for the different channels in your mind. So you can turn off the commercials and you can turn off the weird programs that are making you crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And listen to more of the nice ones that are helping you, that are tracing your field. So that's the thing. So you know, George Soros, who I adore, who's a hero of mine, he made a beautiful university in Hungary, which has been ruined by Putin's pal, who is the new dictator in Colombia, unfortunately. And
in Poland.
So then he wants to make one in the West, and he gave $1 billion or pledged $1 billion. And I don't know exactly how I haven't managed to catch up with it. I think he gave it to Bard College, or he was channeling it through Bard, which is a very innovative, and they do a lot of good.
Yeah,
they have things like go and teach in a prison as part of your study.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And teach yoga to some prisoner. They have things like that. And they're really brilliant. So I don't know how they're going to make a new world university out of it. But we have to do that. You know?
Yeah.
The Buddhists in India had Nalanda University, which had a core curriculum that involved how to train your mind, not just your brain to be manipulative. You know?
So one of the things, Bob, here that, again, this for many people is a bit of an arcane concept. And you do get into it and maybe just get it down dirty, which is the first step towards a realistic worldview is one taken to accept the reality of causation. Understanding both cause and effect is relative and temporarily infinite.
Right.
Ultimately beginningless and endless. We then can confront the causal world more creatively, knowing we are both part of it and potentially all of it. We can face its immensity and dedicate our potential infinite energy towards making the world even better for everyone. So, yeah.
Did you write that? You read it. I like the way you read it. Sounds funny. Better than what I think about. So, I forget
causality.
What I write, you know.
Yeah,
that's really good. Well, you know, there are two things in that. In other words, I don't think the causality is so arcane because actually science, that's the basis of science, is to look into causes. Because by looking into the causes of a bad thing, and a doctor does that too, that's when they prevent that bad thing from happening or they ameliorate this condition of the bad thing. So causation investigation is a thing. You know, there was a president at Amherst College who was a classicist. And he thinks that science is only Western. You know, he did, at least before we talked. And I don't know if he really changed his mind after we did. And he has a story about Galen, the Greek doctor, who analyzed, a ship came in filled with corpses, floated into the harbor in Rhodes, and everybody had died in the ship. And then the people started getting sick in the town. And then people ran to the temple of Athena to stop the plague. And he said, no, we don't go to the Temple of Athena. We see the causes, the dead bodies. They had some infestation. And we burn the ship and the dead bodies, and then we'll be okay. So he considered that the birth of the Western interest in causation rather than the gods causing things. And so that's pretty normal. But I agree when I say that the chicken and egg problem is solved by just letting it go. Letting that chicken and that egg just go back and who's the first chicken and who's the first egg, don't worry about it. What you worry about is which egg am I in? which chicken and which next egg is going to happen. And you just keep work on it in your own sphere. So that's the easy part. The harder part is to sort of open up to the boundarylessness of life, you know, and then realize that what you do now becomes the cause of endless consequence. And so therefore you should, it gives more weight on making good decision, even in tiny baby steps level, rather than a bad one. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're going to get mad, well, just do it in a less violent manner and for shorter time and with less emotion, you know, than just going berserk, you know? Yeah. And so just baby step, try to interfere with habitual causations and make them more consciously designed to be better. And so that's
great. I like that. That's baby steps to interfere with the habitual causation in your life.
That's okay? Right. That's
right. Phenomenal.
So that part is great, but I agree that then the future, although I have a new thing that I've only discovered just now, I learned. See, I didn't have it in mind reading that because I'm most worried about people being sucked in to the fake thing that materialism teaches, which is that you have no soul and no mind. And they even think that Buddha doesn't allow you to have a soul, which is not correct, actually. It's a misinterpretation of Buddhism by materialists, translators. Whereas really you have a soul in the sense that you have a super subtle mental continuum. It isn't a fixed thing like a barcode that never changes, which is what Buddha meant when he said no soul like that. But you have a soul that is a continuum of this very subtle level that goes out of the brain and out of the body and looks for another one. And that's what's called a soul, you know, because Buddha is definitely into the infinite continuity of life.
I remember when you told that, Bob, when we were in Maui at one of these retreats. And
yes.
He was, because he always, whenever he would say soul, just the word, there's always our Buddhist friends up on stage.
I know, you can't
sort
have
of
that.
Slyly over there. Sorry,
I know, they're
buddy.
Rolling
and
their
then
eyes.
You came in and you gave this wonderful little bit of a dissertation on the reality that,
that's
as you
right.
just did.
Heck yes.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you get into there's no future life. And that puts you in the materialist bag, which there were some in Buddha's time. And they were utterly unethical. They theoretically, anyway, probably some of them were ethical around town. But they were unethical as far as there any reason to be ethical, because finally there's no consequence for everything when your mind is nothing, you know. And so Buddha would never agree with that. And so anyway, yes, I was so happy to be able to offer that to Ram Dass and to others who have taken Buddhism as wrongly confirming the materialist thing. But anyway, what I was trying to say is a more simple thing. And what I discovered is, you know, the materialists, however, do, and the existentialists, do convince themselves that they're very brave in accepting being nothing. They think that's a real achievement to accept, okay, I can be nothing. I can let it all go and be nothing. And in a way, that is kind of cool. But on the other hand, I then realized, well, why do people fear being nothing, at least mentally, when they think about it? Because actually, when they're having their teeth drilled or they're having a heart surgery, they want to be unconscious. And even on a more modest level, every night when we're really dog tired after you moved all your furniture there, you want to be unconscious. So you want nothing. You want a brief feeling of unconsciousness, right? Because you've learned, not that because it's really nothing, because it isn't. You're not nothing. You're just not conscious for a while. And you've learned by experience that when you wake up later, you're going to feel renewed and better and you're ready to move some more furniture, whereas you're really sick of it when you go to sleep. So what the thing is they're not really scared of nothing. Well, it means that even the materialist knows in their bones that everything in life is continuity and that everything is infinitely interconnected. You know, queer motion, queer connection at a distance. They have this strange, the two molecules can be connected with their spin. You know, the physicists are all completely flipped out about it. But they know that everything is interconnected. So what they're scared of is not the nothing, if that really was the case, but what they're scared of is what might happen to them after the nothing, once they have no control because they're unconscious. And so that means that even the materialists subliminally knows there will be continuation, because nobody has ever experienced nothing, actually. Because you, and you know when you're unconscious, or you might say, well, that's nothing because I'm unconscious. But you know you've been unconscious. You've slept maybe 10,000 nights, and you kept waking up. So you weren't nothing, actually. And not only that, but some mysterious energy was around that renewed your cells and made you feel more energized in the morning, which, of course, we call the infinite plenum, the clear light of the void, the infinite energy of reality. And Buddha would call the nirvanic reality that you were sleeping in, where nirvana is not a null state. It's a state of infinite love and energy. Mm. You know, if you think of love as being wanting people to have what they need, you know, when you love someone, you want them to have what makes them happy and what they need.
Right.
So in that sense, we're not making it a person. We're saying that the clear light of the void is available for anything that feels depleted of energy, any person or thing, to draw energy from it. You know? Yeah. And that's the deepest nature of reality. So that's why wisdom is bliss, which discovers that experientially, ultimately, but knows it ahead of time inferentially. Because inference gives you a kind of experience, although indirect. So we mustn't negate that experience that you get from valid inference. You
know? And I like what you say here in terms of the example of letting go into sleep, and not nothingness.
That's
and,
it.
But the way that, and again, for me, mindfulness really is the perspective here. As you say, it strengthens your trust in reality.
Yeah.
Beginning to sense the nature of freedom of space like emptiness.
That's it. From one might think, you know, in the bhakti world of Ram Dass, one might think, okay, I'm going unconscious and it's like the curtain of darkness descends and I become unconscious. But I will project the notion in my mind that the infinite love of the universe is Lord Krishna, is his wonderful friend Hanuman, is his beloved Radha, and that I will really be lying in the lap of these wonderful beings who will be loving me in the sense of renewing my energy while I'm just their beneficiary, because and I'm not like I'm just wide open because I'm unconscious, so I'm not somehow blocking any kind of good energy seeping into me from them. And in Buddhism, we think of Tara, you know, the goddess Tara, or the, you know, the Dakini, the Vajra Dakini, you know, the clear light of the void represented as a great mother, you know, and we think of that. So I'm in mother's lap, in mother freedom's, you know, soft and energizing lap.
Mm. I think that, one other major tenet here in this book, although you've gone into it before, maybe even much more detail, and that's around the concept of emptiness, which is a sore point for many people who equate it with nothingness and nihilism and all of that. So I think it's worthwhile for everybody to hear from you. I may be wrong, so you'll correct me, but I think that one time you referred to emptiness, this is the definition you gave, the womb of bliss.
That's right.
Oh,
it's a womb of love. Well, bliss, because bliss is the particular phrase I think I'm fond of is shunyata karuna karbam, which is emptiness, the womb of compassion. But the energy of compassion, of course, is bliss in the sense that compassion springs from empathy, where the enlightened being feels the feeling of the suffering other. But what actually gets radiated toward that being then is not the fact of sharing the suffering, but is sending the bliss, you know, of like overflowing with the bliss. So, you know, the person who feels compassion is empathy by itself, just joining the other person in the suffering doesn't really help them alleviate their suffering. Whereas compassion cannot tolerate that they suffer. Mm. So therefore, it wants them to find bliss. And of course, that would be an absolutely exhausting and impossible thing if it wasn't that. The enlightened being is motivated by the energy of inexhaustible bliss, you know? And I think, for example, Saint Ramdas, Saint Richard, Saint Albert, you know, to me, he's our great American Hindu saint, you know, and he was able to keep a broken body and brain and nervous system long past the time when he normally would have liked to embrace the larger life energy that you do in the death rebirth transition, because the death rebirth transition is not going into a null state. It is surrendering and wide open and discovering that what reality is this vast life energy that is almost too big for any particular embodiment. So it's actually an increase in life force rather than a decrease, is what, you know, what the Tibetan Book of the Dead beautifully and scientifically elaborates, but that's just him saying it impressionistically. So he withheld that joy from himself, which he always used to talk about when I want to go and be with the one, he says, get out of my movie, you know, and be with the one. He had all these ways of talking about it. But the point is, it was because he was channeling as a medium the bliss from the one extending out to everywhere and you know, from the infinite, actually extending out to everywhere, that he was able, that bliss was able to keep his own broken body going well enough to remain conscious of relating to all his friends who he loved. And he wanted to share that with them. He wanted to teach that with them, and which he did, I think, so fabulously.
Yeah, really, and people he had no idea, never met before. That was the beauty of him, that
I
he
know.
Had gotten to this,
people,
the real place of Maharaji Ram Dass, love everyone and tell the truth.
That's right, and many people may have thought he was just clinging to life because he was scared to die, which is totally not true, I'm sure. He totally knew the vastness of letting completely go. When you, like your guy went in Samadhi, your mother was worried because he didn't even bother to breathe, because he didn't, because he was so open, every pore, the oxygen was everywhere in him, and without having to pump it out and suck it out and like put it through the mechanism, he was just wide open, every fiber. So his Samadhi attainment apparently was like that. Yeah. And then there is maybe an imperceptible, you know, circulation of something, but actually the highest state, there's no need to breathe, actually. Yeah, and, you know, some of those great yogis and lamas who show that sometimes when they die, and actually do die clinically, as far as people think, in that their brain flatlines if they have an fMRI on them, and the heart is not beating, there's no pulse, and yet they don't collapse, they sit up straight, they don't smell, their cells do not deteriorate, and they can stay what's called sitting in clear light, is what they call it in Tibetan. And many Indian masters and yogis did that. But they only do that to kind of just create a sense of motivation in the disciple to see that there's some, there's a deeper energy in the universe than just whatever they think they're constantly fabricating in their small body, you know. Yeah. Although that is also precious. But point is, it itself draws from a larger life force, because the ultimate reality of the universe is life force. Mm. It's not dark space. It's not nothing. It's life force reaching across it all.
And when we refer to emptiness, we're referring to empty of the self motivation, of self-interest.
That's simple, easy to understand.
No?
Yeah, well, not relative self-interest is actually okay. You have to be practical. But absolute self-interest is the thing, the absolutizing of self. And actually, in the book, I translated in many contexts as freedom, which is actually also what it is. Because what emptiness is a kind of pure negation, but it's a negation that negates itself. So, for example, in pure freedom, you're also free of freedom, meaning you're not stuck in being separate from committing to relationship or being, you know, connecting to things, that, because you're free to make a choice to do so. Because that's what, so freedom is not bind you into imprison you in freedom as a dualistic idea of the final reality. And so, you know, we say, we don't think of freedom like that. We think of it as a positive, you know, like George Bush, you know, oh, they ate our freedom. But actually, free is a negation also. We say salt-free, sugar-free, trouble-free, right? That means lacking those things. So we could say sugar empty, empty of sugar, empty of this. It's a meaning like that. Whereas nothing, it tries to clamp a positive identification on that which is not there. You see, whereas emptiness is there, which is the freedom of all the relative things to relate to each other. Right. So in a way, what the theory of emptiness, what Buddha's great discovery, which is a scientific discovery of emptiness, by shattering all the atoms like a quantum person in thought experiment combined with samadhi, where he actually saw the fact that there is no indivisible particle or subparticle or subatomic particle. He actually experienced that and burst into the space of freedom, but then burst past a space of freedom, being free of the freedom and compassionately interconnecting again with all life. If you follow me, and not adopting a dualistic idea of some sort of space beyond that is itself. Yeah, because in fact, that's irrational, because if there is a space beyond the relative world, there's a boundary between it and the relative world, and it's not the absolute. It's only a relative space of sort of a moment of separation, but it connects because you entered it. So then you will exit it inevitably. Right. And the point is, by exiting it right away and bringing it with you, then you have the freedom in your relationship. And that's the enlightened being, you know. And for example, Ram Dass had the freedom to stay a decade, maybe. I don't know how long.
It was 23 years in the end.
The Richard Albert body's sell-by date was like had more than a decade before.
But he stayed
to be able to celebrate that even the stroke was the blessing of his guru.
Yeah.
And that came from Rama and Hanuman, and that came from reality finally. It doesn't come from some like exotic weird thing brewed up in a temple someplace. It's reality. You know, the Guruji was himself wrapping in his blankie. He was there in his blankie, but he was sitting in reality, which is where Buddha sits and where Ram Dass was sitting. Because the enlightened person doesn't think reality is apart from holding up the weeping babe and giving it the bottle if you don't have a nipple.
We don't have much time left, but we absolutely, there's a couple of things that I cannot pass by that caught me when I read through the book, and this one's around realistic speech, that chapter in particular.
Oh, yes, right.
And that is so, when you start to, when you talked about the way you think and the reality of what you are doing by just, never mind going and telling somebody off when you're, you know, they cut you off in a car, never mind that, which is so obvious, you're creating stuff. But the thoughts, and it hit me because I was having some mindful awareness of thoughts that I was having. You know, they were like the judgment of one kind or another, or anger at something that isn't going my way. And these thoughts are absolutely critical, as I read through and you're...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right? Speech.
That's absolutely right. That's it. So, you know, whatever... And everyone shouldn't think also that wisdom means that they have to be Buddha before they can have fun. Because anytime we open the mind, that's wisdom. You know, anytime we let go of some self-righteous, I'm it and this is it, I'm right and all that, then anytime we listen to our partners, we kind of go for the smile instead of the sort of imposed whatever we're trying to do, that is wisdom. You know, wisdom is really intelligence, you know, connectedness, you know, relativity, you know. So Buddha, as a scientist, discovering theory of relativity, bring it into ethics and learning and into daily life and daily mindfulness. It's really wonderful. It really is.
But the fact that one has the motivation just simply to use mindfulness as a way to transform. Just as you say, you don't have to be a Buddha. You That's can right. enjoy along the path by That's virtue right. of connecting with true intention and, right. and motivation.
Right, right. And yeah. and mindfulness really is where that critical mind comes. And, you know, like I always think about, you know, Eckhart Tolle, who I like a lot and who lives not far from you. I think he's in Santa Barbara nowadays. And he, that thing about the now thing, but his own discovery of it when he was trying to, when his narrative, his own inner narrative was telling him he should do himself in because life sucked so bad. He didn't know the friendly fun fact that, well, of course it sucks when you're not living it right. And you can fix that and you can have a great time. Mm. But anyway, he was just listening to the to that. He wasn't thinking of it as a fun fact. He was just telling himself it was an absolute case and he should therefore absolutely wreck his, destroy, kill himself. And then another voice rose in his mind that he realized was also his, which was a practice of mindfulness. He found a deeper, more intuitive voice in his own mind saying, why are you listening to that narrative, to that voice of yours, that depressed voice of yours? Who told you that was correct and was authoritative? Who made you obey that? And so that you're now about to do yourself in, eat the bottle of sleeping pills or whatever he was going to do. And that he then listened to the new voice. So he had the freedom to make a choice between voices. And he took the life-affirming voice and saved his life. Mm. So mindfulness, the freedom, finding that freedom in his mind, not to only think that the one voice in his mind, which was saying, I must be pissed off about myself and destroy myself. And he heard another one saying, why should I listen to that? That was a movement of freedom in his mind, a movement of wisdom in his mind. And you could call it mindfulness or wisdom, it doesn't matter. But that saved his life, actually.
Yeah.
So that's really... And he tells that honestly and fearlessly, that story. And his whole great teaching for millions of people rose from that. And that's a gift of freedom.
Yeah.
A gift of emptiness. Because he thought otherwise that head voice was telling him to destroy himself wasn't empty because it was the absolute his voice had to obey it. And mindfulness is therefore an exercise in freedom, actually.
Yeah.
In learning how to live it and use it. And be the free Raghu and the free Bob and the free Eckhart, no? And the free Ram Dass. Yeah. I love it, really. It's so nice talking to you,
yeah,
Raghu. I so must great. Get out that Ojai one of these days.
Yeah, well, we got to get through a little bit more. Let's just, last thing,
yes.
Which is around the importance of a teacher. And I mean, you know our relationship with Neem Karoli Baba. We know your relationship with Geshe. And
yes, Huang Yao and his holiness,
and mm-hmm. and of course his holiness. But I guess I don't know. Are we put more a little bit as our tradition of bhakti yoga of guru kripa and all of that? We put that in a the container that we have, and the thing that makes me happy about it, and you experienced it yourself in Maui at these retreats, where we have this real combination of us, Krishnas and Ram Dass,
and
others, and then on the other side is you and Roshi Halifax and Jack Kornfield and so and
I don't
Sharon.
Think of myself on their side.
No, you're on their side. We want
you. This is much with you guys. No,
yeah,
no,
I know that. They are too. They are too.
Right.
And, but
good.
The reality is that blend of,
yes.
of that heart and then the discrimination aspect that
right.
Neem Karoli Baba had us from the very get-go. He had us without telling us to do anything. We all learned Vipassana meditation. We were all hanging out with Tibetans. You know, look at Danny Goleman and his relationship with His Holiness as well. And I was fortunate to be with a number of different groups of great Tibetan teachers. So that blend, which does still emphasize the reality of the teacher in this case. Is but there's also, you know, on the other side, just to express what you expressed earlier in the book, which is that the Buddha is about, and as His Holiness says, and you know, I heard him talking about some of the problems that had gone on with Buddhist teachers and you know, sexual malfeasance and so on, and he would say, do not take anything on the word of a teacher without you directly experiencing it inside, right?
Yeah.
Words of wisdom.
Right.
And at the same time, there's another level for me by which I wouldn't understand this freedom that you just talked about without being in that particular presence.
Of course. But this is the key of the good. It's the difference between the good teacher and the bad teacher. Mm. There are less good teachers. And the good teacher is the one who wants the student to develop themselves independently to equal or even surpass the teacher. The good, bad teacher wants the student to only be dependent on the teacher.
Mm.
And that when the good teacher wants the student to surpass the teacher, be just as free and just as blissful. And then, of course, that person will be grateful to that teacher. So there will still be tremendous gratitude and respect. But the good teacher does not want just to pick up on a new dependent.
Mm.
They want the reliance on the teacher is very well articulated in Indian thought and both sides of both so-called both sides, Buddhist and Hindu sides, which are really not two sides. They are one Indian classical culture.
Right.
It only became different when the Buddhist one was driven out by invaders who didn't like the idea of the freedom. They didn't want the Indian people to be free. They wanted them to be subservient.
Right.
You know, the conquerors in India who came to India 1,800 years ago. And so, but the classical India, what was unique about it was the teacher wanted the student to become his or her equal and even go and carry the teacher's vision even further. And then the student, when they did, the good one, became so grateful to the teacher that they certainly connected back to the lineage. But the bad one just wants to manipulate people to be dependent on them so they can manipulate and use them like servants. And then eventually the student rebels and it doesn't like them. And unfortunately, one of the really bad things is then the student rejects the original teaching that they liked, that the bad teacher did transmit some of, and before they started manipulating and abusing.
Mm.
And so then, unfortunately, the student sometimes will throw out the whole goodness of the teaching and miss out on what they learned that helped them before they got abused. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's a tricky thing about it, but I think it has to do with coming, for example, in the initiatory level of it, there is a thing in the tantras, either Shaivite or Buddhist, where you say that you don't really get initiated unless you perceive the teacher as indivisible from the reality of the deity, you know, the nirvanic or the ultimate or whatever you want to call it, you know, Satchidananda. So that's the excuse that the bad teacher uses to say, well, we had that ritual and you had to see me as Vajrasattva or something. And so now you have to do what I tell you and whatever it is. I want a Cadillac. I don't want some Volkswagen, you know, this kind of thing. And that's completely mistaken, because the reason that in initiatory thing, you see the teacher as indivisible from his teaching. It's like you look at a statue of the Buddha, a statue of Hanuman, and you think of the reality of Hanuman. And it was the more deep your bhakti is when you feel practically it is in the statue. But you never make a mistake of thinking the statue is Hanuman. You don't make, you know, Hindus and Buddhists are not idolaters in the sense of they don't think the statue is the ultimate reality. They think the statue is simply a channel, a medium to the presence of, and they have rituals about statues where they say this may this be a channel for Hanuman to come through it. But nobody makes that mistake. So similarly, the guru is a channel of that, but the goal is where the student themselves feels one with Hanuman. They themselves feel one with Rama. They themselves feel one with Buddha. And then they try to represent that to the others and be truly loving and truly helpful and truly beautiful and whatever it is.
Which is what Ram Dass was so successful at, right? Ram Dass.
You use the ritual event as an excuse to domineer people, then you're missing the whole thing of Indian spirituality and Indic science, which is that everybody can be one with the ultimate. And that's what the Indian gods want. They don't just want a slave.
Mm.
They want someone to be one with them, you know. That's the greatness of Indian science. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's, I was just saying, interjecting just before about Ram Dass, that's what he became. He yes. imbued what yes. that he called it the jewel of Neem Karoli Baba, came back to the West, wrote Be Here Now, which is, by the way, Bob, 50th anniversary is this year.
I know, celebrating that's a new great it. Thing yeah. by you yeah. guys put out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
so
we're loving that new book. We've been reading it a lot.
Oh, that's great. And so in that sense, it's exactly what you just said, which is, the student or the disciple or the devotee in this case
yes.
imbues this and then shares that in a way that's non-differentiated from the source. And
absolutely.
Everyone has a chance. And we have seen this over these decades
yes.
of how that has manifested. And you've seen it when you come to the retreat. You see all these people
yes.
and being there.
Oh, I
and
see
that.
It. Oh, listen, I do. I totally into it. It's yeah. all amazing.
Yeah, it's all amazing.
It's all amazing.
Thanks for writing this book, though. I appreciate
you.
It
thank
because
you for
it's
letting
got
people know about it.
Yeah, and it's.
I hope a lot of people enjoy reading it and it makes them happy. And anybody who's practicing anything, if it's making them miserable, it couldn't quite be right. Is what
yeah,
I'm saying.
Right.
Whether
exactly.
they call it Buddhism, whether they call it Hinduism, whether they call it Judaism, whether they call it whatever it is, the great spiritual leaders of humanity. All wanted everyone to be happy. None of them wanted to be exploited by the emperor of Rome or the emperor of anywhere to be resigned to being more miserable.
Our legacy.
That's my point. My point.
Our legacy is not to become miserable schleppers. It's not
that's,
our legacy.
That's
right?
it. That's it.
and that's what
and that's
this
the
book
only
pronounces.
Way, that's the only way we're going to have this love revolution, this devotional bhakti, love, whatever you call it, bodhisattva vow revolution, to change the bad guys from wrecking our planet, this beautiful planet that Buddha loved, Krishna loved, Maharaji loved, and Ram Dass loved, the beautiful Maui. We're not going to let them do it, but we won't do that if we're not happy. If we just get angry, then they'll use that as an excuse to continue to be militaristic and nasty, you know?
Yeah.
And burn more oil and throw more coal on it. You know?
Right. So great
right?
to see you.
All the best.
So
thank
you great. And everybody, by the way, it'll all be linked up on the show notes where you can order. The book is available now, right, Bob?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
Wisdom
yeah.
is Bliss, four friendly
Wisdom
fun facts
bliss.
That can change your life. Hay House, wherever you buy books, you should find it.
There you
right.
go. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
you,
you.
Thank you Bob.
Thank you, Raghu. I love it. Thank you, Ram Dass. If you're listening, we'll all be more happy. Take care. Okay, bye.